When you're in a crisis and, you know, your company's breached and everybody's looking at you, or the CEO is breathing over your neck going, what's going on? You know, the tension's high, and to be calm under chaos is a practice skill, just like everything else we talk about. But it goes miles to reassuring the leadership that you're dealing with, your team. Everybody takes a deep breath and they can see that there is a calm leader at the helm of the ship.
From ExitBeam, this is the new CISO, a show about the people who lead IT security teams, the challenges they face, and how they overcome them. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe to hear our new episodes first. I'm Steve Moore, and I'm back with Ron Banks, CISO of Toyota Financial Services and 29-year Air Force veteran. Be sure to check out part one, where we discuss Ron's early career and opinion on public-private partnerships. Today, we're picking up where we left off on one of my favorite topics, China. Ron shares his take on the nation-state's 3D chess and imparts his career advice for up-and-coming security professionals. The future of both corporate and national security hinges upon the efficacy of cybersecurity leadership. So, why did China go dark? What key attributes does a CISO look for in a young manager? And how can communication make or break your success as a leader? I'd like to go back if we could, because I am extremely interested in something you said earlier. You were talking about how much of the activity that's tracked, in particular out of China, we know it's ongoing, but it's gone relatively quiet. You know, in 2014, 2015, 2016, we saw a lot of activity I'll get to the why later, but it was airlines. So OPM, airlines, hotels, scheduling platforms, for a specific need, but it was widespread. Sort of building this, what I'll call it plainly, the sort of Facebook of Americans for a number of reasons. Now it seems like it's shifted, or at least gotten a little more active on the critical infrastructure. And then now this is sort of a counterbalance if there's ever any offensive action we take, you know, halfway around the world. You obviously have spent some time reading, researching, and understand this. Like, what do you think would be the likely outcome? Is it more than just disruption? If that government or any other were to attack different elements of the United States, what do you think they would be? And why do you think that activity, for whatever reason, has gone quiet of late? I guess it's a twofold question.
You got a lot there, Steve. So we look back at, if we're talking about just China, and starting in the late 90s, Chinese PLA were very loud about their cyber activity. They didn't care who saw them. They were all about stealing intellectual property, and they literally skipped a generation of research and development to, in a matter of a decade, get to par with the United States from everything from energy, transportation, military, you name it. They stole it and reproduced it very, very quickly and in large numbers. Simultaneously, yes, they did this sort of, what you call the Facebook Rolodex thing. It was all about how do they understand who are the movers and shakers and what dirt can we dig up on them so that we can turn them or extort them or get them to do what we want them to do when we want them to do it. That still is going on. And they were, again, very overt about that. They became more sophisticated over time. And I think where we are now is with, you know, they're on a 100-year strategy, and their 100-year strategy is playing chess on the three-dimensional chessboard called global geopolitical tensions or world politics. We struggle because we keep changing administrations every 4 to 8 years, and we spend so much political infighting inside the United States. We're deciding on the checkerboard, are we red or are we black? But we're fighting an adversary that's playing three-dimensional checkers with a 100-year strategy. So where they are is, whether or not they want global dominance or not, their sole purpose is to make sure the U.S. government has diminished global power, especially in the Pacific region. And to do that, they're going to take all sorts of means to make sure that happens. And right now, what we're seeing is tensions are high around Taiwan, the South China Sea, and they have been paying very close attention to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, both in 2017 and over the last 2 years. And they have literally taken good notes, and they figured out, yeah, okay, so cyber isn't maybe the Pearl Harbor that everyone feared it to be, but it can have a dramatic input and impact on a nation's ability to go to war, to sustain itself, to be focused on external conflict outside of its borders. And China's realized that by being inside all our infrastructure, they have the ability to maybe disrupt is a good word, but they can go to the disable and destroy mode as well. And so rather than be focused on the logistics of going to war, if that's where our future is, we'd be, how do we keep the lights on? How do we feed our families? How do we protect our families at home? And we're less concerned about an overseas war. And so, I mean, that's their long-range plan. They don't have to necessarily destroy the United States through cyber means, but they can do a lot to distract, disable, and achieve their objectives, or at least enable the success of their kinetic objectives in the China Sea, for example.
So do you think, you mentioned sort of on the kinetic side, I mean, one of the strange things that we're even seeing, I find this fascinating, and I'm kind of putting too much weight on China, but little small things, even them going after researchers at universities, and if not trying to steal, just bribe and inviting them in. And, you know, they're finding places where there's funded research by the Navy or Department of Defense and inviting these professors in. I find that fascinating. I find it fascinating that they'll take another otherwise well-meaning, just a student that's here studying, and use persuasion to get them to do something, you know, and install malware or to take information. And then this is, all of this, I guess, this can be a little controversial, but even just the number of Chinese nationals at our southern border that are showing up and here, and maybe for good reason. And I think that's, you know, that's a hot topic, but you wonder, of the, I don't know, the 20 or 25,000 just this year that they've found, how many of those may mean harm? Maybe zero. But I find all of this in concert absolutely fascinating. And from the cyber side to the more kinetic side, especially with situations like the potential for problems in Taiwan. Do you have a thought or opinion on that?
Well, again, this is three-dimensional chess. They're going to use every mean and method at their beck and call. So it can be espionage, it can be outright extortion, it can be cyber-related, it can be misinformation campaigns. They've really learned, again, from the Russians on how to do disinformation. It could be formal political espionage. It can be outright theft of intellectual property, the co-opting of faculty and students at universities or research institutions. For them, that's just one of many arrows in their quiver, and they're going to use every single one of them. Why? Well, they've seen the United States and Russia do that. We're very good at that. And so that's simply a page out of our own playbook they're using against us. And, you know, I go back to what I said earlier. Espionage has been going on since the caveman days, and it's just evolved to cyber, and that's just another tool in amongst a series of tools that they have at their disposal to promote and achieve their objectives.
Something else you mentioned earlier that I kind of smiled at is, and I had to learn some of this the hard way, but how relatively loud they used to be and how they've learned to be a little quieter in their activities. They used to just make a big mess and wouldn't care on the cyber side.
I go back to what I said, with the FBI. The FBI is super concerned that they went dark and they can't find them anymore. That used to not be the case, that the Chinese used to be very overt about it and noisy, and we could see them and we saw what they were doing. Now they've learned. If they want to be quiet, they will be quiet.
Overt, not necessarily destructive, though. But what I mean, may cause harm, but not intentional destruction. It was very rare to see anything happen in that regard. We've mentioned it a couple times. I want to make a moment, if for those that listen, we know that this is, our goal is to have an element of virtual mentorship for those that may not have it. That's kind of the passion behind the show. We don't attempt to monetize anything. We typically, well, I don't know that we've ever talked about product here. And Ron didn't ask this, but I want to just mention his book if you're interested in the things that he says. More of what he has to say is in his book, which is Confronting the Cyber Storm. I'm not getting paid to say this, but I think that it does have a 5-star review on Amazon. So that's, I think that if you're curious or would like to learn more about all of what he's talked about, it's available there for a modest price.
And I will say, Steve, thank you for that. You know, authors will tell you they don't make much off of their books. I don't either. It is a note of warning. It is meant to be a dissertation, so it's dry with lots of footnotes. So just hang tight as you read through it. There are some good bits when you get to the latter part, but it is very academic.
I think that is something that's a little bit of a curse or a reality of a lot of what happens in cyber, but you've articulated all of it very well here, and I would expect to find more of the same in the book. I've not yet read it, but I wanted to call that out. You said you made a switch, if I can ask, from was meant to be a dissertation. Clearly, if you still published a book, it was still a hell of a lot of work. Like, what was the point that you're like, you know what, like, I'm going to do a book? And how many times did you hate the fact that you said you were going to do a book while doing a book?
You know, I didn't start out thinking it was going to be a book. It was starting out to be a dissertation, and I had 3 PhDs who were my committee and agonized over each chapter, and that was very painful. But it was meant to, it was supposed to be done while I was in active duty, and I got out a year earlier than I thought I was going to, because the corporate opportunity presented itself, and that was my goal anyways. And so I leapt at the opportunity to do that. And so the dissertation was just about done. I elected, like, well, shoot, I put all this time, 2 years worth of my life into it. I'm going to just finish this thing and publish. Might as well. And so I went that route.
I mean, it's 365 pages.
And it's cut down. that's not the long version.
Oh, my. Hey, I want to talk a little bit with you about just some of your advice to folks in general that are, you know, one of my famous questions, I don't know if it's famous or not, but it's just advice that you would give your younger self, which is really a mentorship question, to say, what might that be? Are there things, you know, there's younger people that are coming up that are young 20s that are getting into cyber. What advice would you have for them? Or maybe better yet, somebody who's in one of the armed services, who's looking to, as a method to transition into a different career path when they finish serving our country?
Okay, boy, there's a lot to unpack there. So first and foremost, cyber is technical. There are jobs within my cyber team that are far less technical than others. Obviously, you know, I've got a cloud security engineer. That's pretty technical. But I've also got risk analysts that are less technical. And so the point there that I'm making is, even if you're not technical but want to get into cyber, there is a path into cyber that's available. The other thing I would say is, despite what I just said, I recommend that you do some of the basic certs, certifications that are out there, Security Plus, Network Plus. Get the foundation of all things cyber and touches on the technical aspects. And if you find that interesting, you've got a future there, I would say. And if you are good at the technical side, go deeper into it. And, you know, you need to be good at programming and probably more than one language. And you need to be creative and inquisitive and have an investigative mindset to be in cyber, because what we do on a day-to-day basis, and we're presented with alerts or logs or situations that at face value may not be exactly what it seems. And you know, you've got to be inquisitive, and you got to be able to and want to have the drive to go peel that onion back and figure out what's the rest of the story, or what's really going on. Is this normal or is this abnormal? And that mindset is so important to our profession.
Absolutely. That be inquisitive, and then also have the want to, is what I'd call it. That was one of the key things I'd evaluate on in a younger, newer person. Do I think they'd have the persistence in them to stay at it, whatever it is? And do they have that want to? Shifting gears a little bit, more of a leadership focused question. If you're hiring for a director or a manager that would report to you, somebody who would, be briefing you and carrying forth some of your strategy and maybe presenting, co-presenting with you in meetings, how do you evaluate young leaders and what are the expectations that you have for them today? And I'm sure that's partially colored by your experience in service as well. So like, what are you looking for, skills, abilities, mindsets of a new young leader?
So that young manager, new manager, or even more senior manager who's maybe going to be a director, there's a combination of things I'm looking for. And the higher you go, it becomes more about the leadership and the personality fit as opposed to just the technical chops. But the young manager, you got to have some technical chops. You got to understand the craft that we operate within, the various pieces and parts from AppSec to NetSec to, security operations to identity, all the pieces and parts that go into it. You need to understand it. You don't need to be able to do it all, but you need to understand it and how they fit together. But you also need then to go deep into a specialty. And I expect that young manager to be deep into one specialty. And then it's the leadership management side. Manager's all about driving a project and applying resources effectively to that project to achieve an objective. The leadership side of that is how do you inspire and get people to do more than what they thought they could do? I'm looking for this combination of manager leader that has the ability to be articulate and to be succinct and be able to communicate. Yes, I need super technical cyber experts, but if you can't communicate what you know or what has to be done, then you're not effective in that management leadership role that becomes later in the career. And so, never pass up the opportunity to practice communication, written or verbal, understand and be, again, inquisitive and hungry for leadership knowledge and how do you improve your own self to get to that next level. But you can learn through observation, by reading, by practicing. And I expect, those leaders to be driven to do all of those things.
So, Ron, pursuant to being a better communicator and being a better leader, if you were giving advice to maybe a new direct report or just someone you were mentoring, what might you suggest? Is there a class or a book or even a guide, something online that you would point them toward that you have found useful in the past?
So there are a ton of effective communication books and literature out there. I actually go back to one in the Air Force that they had that was written, 40 years ago that's still germane. So I'm not going to say any one thing. I would say that, again, be the continual learner and go read many of these. Talk to mentors, get their opinions. At the end of the day, it just comes down to practice, practice, practice. I go back to sort of what you said when you wrote your chapter. I thought I knew English grammar pretty well until I had 3 PhDs just tear apart my understanding and writing ability. That's a whole different animal. But practice is important. And your comment about everything you need to know in the first 8 seconds applies to the things that you want out of your boss. That's either a decision or you need his help or recommendation or influence to change the course of things. For the most part, general communication doesn't have to follow that rule, but when you want something or need help, you've got to be very succinct, and it does just take practice doing it. I would also say on the verbal side, we tend to, in this digital world, be much better at digital communication than verbal communication. Again, practice, practice, practice. I was super afraid of public speaking growing up in my early days in the Air Force, and it just comes with time. Be authentic about who you are and stay true to the core of what you know, and you'll have the confidence to do well when you're speaking. But then be open to constructive feedback on not only what you say, but how you said it. One of my pet peeves are speakers who say every 3 words or inject the word right. You know what I'm saying, right? And that just drives me crazy. That's not effective communication. So I think, Mark Twain summed it up best. if I had more time, I would have written you a shorter letter. And that's so true, because to write and to speak succinctly takes thought and deliberate effort on your part to be good at it, to be articulate and succinct. And so it just doesn't happen overnight. You have to practice, you have to learn, you have to ask for feedback, constructive criticism.
There's a great art in learning how to pause, and I still fall into the trap like I did just then. Learning to pause, especially in rooms where you're being evaluated by senior staff, if you seem in too much of a hurry, you need to be quick about what you're doing. But you know what I'm about to say. If you see someone who's new or inexperienced, or they're new to the room, a lot of times they want to share all they know very quickly. And they want to run 200 miles an hour. And it just ruins the whole delivery. Learning how to slow down and sometimes pause is a skill that I had to learn the absolute hard way. Fitting into the room is part of it. The delivery of not using an just pause, and then paying attention to the rate at which you speak is crucial when doing executive briefings, when being deposed. I've had that. When you're doing these, when you're delivering. But I still, as much work as I've done, I will still, depending on how comfortable I am, or especially on this show, putting in moments where there's these uncontrolled fillers. It's a very tough thing to break, but it's absolutely worthwhile. The thing that I learned post-breach, I'll tell you this, when you're dealing with customers that are angry, being able to modify how you speak and remove emotion and keeping people, I call it comfort and confidence, is super important as well. So they have to think that this leader who's in charge has the ability to keep things cool and has a plan and has confidence, and that is then contagious. I know it's something that's taught you as an aviator and all the rest. Maybe spend a second, if you have, on the calm being contagious. I'm sure you have a perspective on that.
I do indeed, and it does go back to my military days. Yeah, I can remember, so this is how old I am, in Desert Storm with some very large packages, having the very seasoned fighter pilot leader lead, and you know, you're going into combat and your emotions are high, you're super anxious, you know, you're wondering, you know, you're going to get shot at, you're going to have to kill somebody, all those things run through your mind. And so you're not on your game because you're super anxious. But then as you push out and you hear this very calm, almost radio voice, fighter pilot leader talk about what's going on, build a picture for you, and just put everybody at ease, goes miles for the competency of everybody else who's listening on the radio. And it's also interesting, the exact opposite was true as well. When we're hearing our fellow fighter pilots and other airframes get shot at, and their voice goes up in octaves, and the emotion is incredible over the phone, and how contagious that emotion is. Once that calm is obliterated on the radio, all pandemonium ensues. And so my calm fighter pilot leader was the voice of reason to, through his voice alone, instill calm and confidence back into the rest of the dozens and dozens of people who were on that radio. And I learned that long ago. The art was, when the chips are down, and this is true in cyber too, when you're in a crisis and, you know, your company's breached and everybody's looking at you, or, you know, the CEO is breathing over your neck going, what's going on? You know, the tension's high, and to be calm under chaos is a practice skill, just like everything else we talk about. But it goes miles to reassuring the leadership that you're dealing with, your team. Everybody takes a deep breath and they can see that, you know, that there is a calm leader at the helm of the ship, and that makes all the difference in the world. It is very, very applicable.
It is something that we need to practice more of. And the simplest might be, and this is going to sound a little silly, but if you ever find yourself getting angry while driving, it's a perfect opportunity to quite literally slow down, calm down. If you see yourself, I coach people on this and use this as an example for them to focus on, because sometimes you can't synthesize a crisis at work. So I'm like, do you ever get angry when driving? And they say, yes. You know, have you ever yell at someone inside your, yes. Okay. Take that same mindset and fix that back to that comfort and confidence. Pay attention when when your voice gets high, what happens? What's happening to your body? How do you slow your voice down? How do you pay attention to the intonation of what you're saying? And also the rate at which you speak. But then when you're trying to really make a point, you can't speak this way all the time. But if you begin to speak faster, like I am right now, people will eventually lose you. If you're trying to get people to zero in on you and calm them, you have to say, I can remember a conversation I had during a significant incident. Everyone was upset because we were getting ready to throw the adversary out and we needed to do a remediation event. And everyone was very unsure as to the plan. And just as we talked about now, I had to let them know, this is an extremely well-tested plan. It's been used in many organizations. Right now, we have an adversary in our environment that may mean harm to us and certainly means harm to our customers. We have a plan in place to remove this individual from this environment. Multiple things will need to happen, and we all need to work together for it to be successful. Things are going to, you know, there's a, and you go on, right? You say there's, you know, within the next 12 hours, we will remove this adversary. We are going to reset this environment. For those that are unfamiliar, it's as if you had an arrhythmia in your heart. We're going to stop the heart and we're going to restart it. For those of you that have had to be shocked back into rhythm, that's exactly what we're going to do here. We are not going to destroy anything of our own environment. But what we do will keep the adversary out and we'll remove him from this environment, right? So, okay, now this plan has been used many, so it's the rate and everything. And that conversation in particular was many years ago, but I had people call me afterwards because the old Steve would have been a little bit squirrely. And I don't know if I was what prompted me to even make that change. But yeah, that applies. So, I mean, I think that your advice from, you know, fighter pilot to executive, you know, to CISO, that's another really important thing for a young incident responder to think about. And then the other thing I'll say about communication is how much of it can be reused, meaning how many of your emails can I forward unedited? So then we both get credit, right? So let's say I work for you and I write crummy emails. You can't really forward that. You kind of have to rework it. But if I write you something that's just aces, you can forward that, and then we both shine collectively. Ron, man, I really appreciate you being here with us today. You've shared a ton of great information for listeners of all backgrounds. We close every show with the same question, and it's not necessarily literal, or it could be, but it's pursuant to the name of our show, The New CISO. What does being a new CISO mean to you?
Well, the new CISO is and must be also now a business leader. And more I'm seeing technical experts rise through the ranks and be good at their craft, but still not quite grasp the business side of what's going on, understand budgets and P&L and, you know, what it takes to really run a business. But if the CISO of today is going to be effective, you've got to get into the business side of what we do and be able to speak to what, you know, to understand their vernacular and to talk in a way that talks risk at their level, that talks the defense of the firm at their level. So the CISOs of the future, the present and the future, really have to bridge that gap from technical competence, leadership, business acumen in a way that they can influence the business for the positive, to help the business go in a direction that they want to go in a secure fashion. And so the CISOs of the present and future have to also be business leaders. And more I'm seeing CISOs be divorced from the CIO. Regulation is going that way anyways, but more and more now seeing CISOs report to the CFO or legal officer, or like I do, directly to the CEO. And that's a testament to where CISOs are and where we're going as a key leader of the firm.
Excellent answer, Ron. Thank you again for all of what you shared with us today. I really appreciate your time.
You bet, Steve. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That is it for this episode of the new CISO. Thank you for listening. Check out more episodes on xbeam.com/podcast. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe to get brand new episodes first.